are again. Me and Rudaloo Swanzor breaking all the R-O-O-L-S, checking the breezes for N-O-O-S of the big old world and all indefatigable, like getting ready to pay our D-O-O-S in the service of the capital T-R-O-O-T-H. I solemnly swear by my top right canine, T-O-O-T-H. This is episode 12. Of the history, myths, tales, and legends of the dogs of the chase in exile and of the chase in Doggerland by order of the great, high, and humble Dogger, otherwise known as Ruse Doggerland Tales. Today, same as last time, we're feeling hopeful about the great project to raise Doggerland, the ancestral home of the dogs, which rests now beneath the North Sea because of our communication with an entire team of specialists who've pledged to contribute their expertise to the project, and we'll touch on that more in a little while, because Rue and I have decided that it's time to begin to tell the tale of how millions of years ago, the forerunners of the chase began a process that is still ongoing and that is likely, by far, the most momentous intervention in the evolution of a creature by another group of creatures. I'm speaking, of course, of the decision millions of years ago of a pack of dogs to take subtle charge of our ape ancestors, though perhaps at the beginning of the project it wasn't clear necessarily to the dogs who took it up exactly what the purpose was, nor did any of them imagine, surely they couldn't have predicted, it's fair to say, what results would appear over 1,000, 10,000, 50,000, let alone a few million years. Who knows how we might have turned out if a couple crazy apes hadn't run into a band of bold, scheming canines while the paint was, so to speak, still drying. What green and fragrant valley might have enchanted our ancestors so thoroughly that they stayed forever humming wild and innocent songs? And would we have avoided the infamy of the Neanderthals who fell prey to the wiles of shrewder beasts and to their own base instincts? Nobody thinks the process is over either, although most people believe we're the ones who've been directing it all along. I get the sense sometimes that Rue de la Rue Swanzor knows a thing or two she's not telling me. Is it a metaphor for something that just now, as she stretched herself out, pressed along my thigh, that some of my Earl Grey tea with bergamot sloshed onto her ears, dampening and scenting them slightly, as they lay like fuzzy garnishes draped over the edge of the chipped salad plate I'm using as a saucer? Bergamot? From the Italian by way of Istanbul? Black tea? Howick Hall, Northumberland, Earl Grey, Prime Minister, British East India Company? On her ears? I never know. I often suspect that accidents involving Rue de la Rue Swanzor are full of meaning and portent. What did it mean, then, she asked just now, when that skunk sprayed me on my face and on my mark? So how's this for an ambiguous equation? Summer plus skunk plus night plus bath is the equal or opposite or reverse of winter plus tea plus morning plus perfume. If I even have all the terms right, it's still insoluble. Never mind the intensification and tension introduced by the whole nature, i.e. the skunk, versus putative refinement, i.e. Earl's and ancestral memory. Who has time for it? One morning, very early, a dream woke me and I had to get up. While E, the great high and humble dogger, who's known to me then only as my dear dog, was missing from the end of my bed. Increasingly paralyzed as he was, he suffered from a genetic disease, a progressive tetraplegia that eventually rendered him incapable of independent movement, and which was the reason for his premature death. His absence from where I had lain him was shocking. Imagine the worst. Somehow he had managed to leave the bedroom after first falling from twice his standing height, if he could have stood. How did he open the door? How did he fall, drag himself across the floor, and leave without my having heard any part of the adventure or misadventure? I wondered, since I had evidently slept through everything else, if he had tumbled down the stairs and pictured him lying broken on the rug at the bottom of them, dead or dying. I suppose my wife or one of my children must have left the door ajar, otherwise Wiley couldn't have opened it. But it wasn't in the upstairs hall, or behind any of the closed doors, bedroom, bathroom, closet, or on the kiln downstairs framed in its geometry of green, cornflower, and vermilion. They must have heard my steps as I descended. The treads of my house have a long farmhouse creak that says charm to some and project to others. An acute and practiced ear can tell from a single note on that instrument which everyday heels and toes are headed up or down, almost as easily as one can discern between the voices in a house. It's a simple matter of weight and gait. So they heard me, they must have, and undoubtedly guessed that I was looking for Wiley, and had known I would find them there if I awoke at all, and being dogs, had chosen to allow things to happen as they might, trusting, I suppose, that my reaction would be mild and investigative, or at least not uncontainably unhinged. A pair of tall, peebled dogs appeared and flanked me as I made my way toward the kitchen, having reached the first floor. With their tails high, they ran effortless circles around me until I stopped, having at last found my dog. While E peered at me from his perch on a low cushion, almost a pillowed bowl, that looked as if it had been made from the outstretched wings of an enormous pheasant, one overlapping the other and pointing in opposite directions as if to mimic the shape of an eye or a wide kayak. Next to him, inside that brilliant oscillated cradle of gold and purple, lay a retinue of smaller dogs wedged beneath his shoulders like bolsters so that when he barked or turned, the effort wouldn't cause him to fall over. His disease had profoundly weakened him by then. These helpers earned affectionate licks which he applied from time to time without comment, but with obvious gratitude. It was no dream, weird and unbelievable as it sounds. I ran to Wiley and held his face against my cheek, happy that he was safe, momentarily heedless of the dozen or so additional dogs who were crowded around, making toast, sitting at my table, scrutinizing the contents of my cupboards and fridge, pawing and panting at one another, mixing the sounds of sniffing and melodious dog talk with the scents of singed rye bread, butter, and tea. I couldn't understand them then, not at all. While he communicated to his attendants his preference that I sit with him in his bed, and allowed me to hold him on my lap while I watched and listened in dumbstruck amazement. As the council of the chase in exile wagged and sang, and growled its way through discussions concerning numerous issues, including questions arising from the great project to lift Doggerland. While E filled me in on most of it later, other dogs who were present that night sometimes contribute nuance to my memory of it, almost always adding a gratuitous comment on my bewilderment and awkwardness as I accepted the refreshments they offered. "The face you made when we offered you the elk maxilla to gnaw," one said recently, guffawing and convulsing as only a mirthful dog can. But I guess I must have done all right, because the next time the Council of the Chase scheduled a meeting, I was invited, although maybe that was mostly because they wanted to be sure plenty of bread and butter were available so they wouldn't have to cater it themselves, so to speak. Not that they hadn't been managing that simple feat more or less forever. And that's how I first learned that what every dog person wants to be true, that there's more to dogs than we know, and deeper reasons than we can explain for our friendship with them. And finally, like I promised, on to our ongoing dialogue with our steadfast friends in the geology and marine engineering realm, who, though they're ever so busy with their paid projects, nevertheless keep the great project's fires stoked, as it were, with their diligent plumbing of the forces and angles and pressures and hardware requisite to the job. This morning, a circumspect scientist named Hawkhurst, obviously an alias, posted a series of schematic drawings to the Chase's electronic mailbox, which he introduced with the following note, which included his permission to quote. It's addressed to the great, high, and humble Dogger, the dogs of the Chase in exile, to me, and to Rue de la Rue Swansor. Dear Sirs, Please see the attached drawings, which I hope will illuminate the difficulties inherent in the great project while also providing some substantial encouragement with regards to its practicability. Excuse me. Then, of course, he goes on about the levers and explosions for a bit, mentions the inevitable and lamentable disruption of submarine peace, explores options for dividing the plate of Doggerland into sections that would then be reassembled on the surface, and the mechanisms through which the parts could be permanently rejoined using gigantic iron parabolas, pending final assessment of stability, and so forth. I get the sense he's impatient with having to explain all of it to an audience of non-engineers and dogs, but soldiers on anyway. Maybe if he says it's okay, I'll post the drawing he sent, and some of you can help him with the drudgery of making it all make sense to me. Hawkhurst says, obviously the cost to accomplish all of this in manpower alone would be staggering, and then gives a figure he calls little more than a back-of-the-envelope ballpark estimate of more than €1 trillion. With materials, he adds, including roughly 500 million tons of metal, not to mention insurance, permits, licenses, fees, gratuities, lobbying costs, and so on, will definitely put the great project at the top of the list of man's most expensive construction undertakings. Rue de la Rue Swansor rolled her eyes and stayed flat on her side. We knew it would cost money, she said. What's that thing you say about pounding fools? Ever notice a gift some folks have for telling misinterpretation? It'll cost more than that, too, she said. 10 times that. 20. The dogs of the chase and exile are not without resources. Hawkhurst will be happy to hear that. So here I am, with my evidently wealthy dog, who never offers a penny in support of her room and board, even as I sink ever deeper into the common troubles of my age. She looks up at me serenely as I arrange the scarves around my neck, whose lines of twining color remind me of the ocean, of the streams of story in Rushdie's pretty book, but also of prison escapes and nonce gallows. I hold her head tight to mine and tell her I love her. Her fur brushes against my knuckles, a feeling I'll remember all day. So thanks again for listening. It's John Perry and Rue de la Rue Swansor for The Great Project and The Dogs of the Chase and Exile. By order of the great high and humble dogger, be sure to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, YouTube, Instagram, Instadog, Woofer, Apple Podcast, and everywhere podcasts are cast. Remember to become a patron of The Great Project on Patreon and to flip a coin into the Toast and Tea Kitty to keep the refreshments coming. And remember, puppies the way!